Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the first presidential debate in terms of whether the American people are well served by these few debates that are controlled and circumscribed by both parties, and where the role of journalists in probing questions is limited and lacking. Jay Rosen, a professor of journalism at New York University and the author of What Are Journalists For?, joins us. His award-winning blog, Think Press, offers critical analysis of journalism and the press. Then we'll go to Venezuela and get an assessment of where the candidates stand in the last days before Sunday's presidential election. Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for the UK Guardian, joins us to discuss the conflicting polls that give Hugo Chavez a lead between 5 and 10 points and others that give his challenger Enrique Capriles a 4-point lead. And finally, since we appear to be living in the new Gilded Age, we will look back into a fascinating character from the last Gilded Age with Janet Wallach, the author of a new book, The Richest Woman in America, Hetty Green in the Gilded Age. We will discuss similarities between the current Gilded Age and the last and comparisons between the plutocrats of today and those that the thrifty Quaker Hetty Green despised in her day. Joining us now is Jay Rosen, a professor of journalism at New York University. His award-winning blog, Press Think, at pressthink.org, puts forth critical analyses of journalism and the press. He is the author of the book, What Are Journalists For?, and numerous articles for The Nation, Columbia Journalism Review, The Chronicles of Higher Education, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Los Angeles Times. He serves as a member of the Wikipedia Advisory Board. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jay Rosen.
Thank you for having me again. You're
quoted in the Associated Press in terms of last night's presidential debate and commenting on the moderated PBS's Jim Lehrer, saying that he lost control of the time and the topics during the debate, quoting, "He didn't really ask questions. I don't know where he got the idea that saying, talk about the differences between you is a question. It's not a question. It's just an invitation to talk." So was he trying to work out this new format? I mean, why do you think he lost control?
Well, I don't know why he settled on that particular theme of what are the differences between you. It seems to me that what are the differences between them is what you want the listeners, the audience, to arrive at, not what you want the candidates to start with. Because if you start that way, it is just kind of an invitation to further stump speeches. So that seemed curious to me, but the candidates took control in the sense that they talked over the time limits. They took whatever time they wanted. They didn't really pay attention to the questions very much, and so we saw a weak moderator. Now, some people think a weak moderator is actually good because the debate is about the candidates. It's not about the moderator. And this is where we get into some of the, you know, the issues, the subtleties, the arguments that we need to have about a very important event.
So whose role do you think it is to ask the real questions, assuming that my understanding of what people are interested in is in any way correct? And that is that I think a lot of people, and particularly who don't quite know who Romney is, are probably interested in why he's refused to reveal his taxes and interested in the remarks that were made in that surreptitious tape about the 47%. Those questions were conspicuously absent. Is it Jim Lehrer's job to bring that up or Obama's?
Well, almost all questions were absent because we're only talking about a handful of questions that did get asked. But Jim Lehrer's approach seemed to be that he would confine the debate to the things that the candidates were ready, willing, and able to talk about, which is different than asking them to address the issues Americans care about. And one of the things he didn't do last night was try to inject issues that maybe had been slighted by one candidate or another or both, because that's just not how he saw his role. And his job, as he saw it, was to let the candidates lay out their different visions of how to fix the American economy and the role of government. And that's pretty much how he moderated it.
Again, I'm speaking with Jay Rosen, professor of journalism at New York University, and his award-winning blog is PressThink at PressThink.org. He's also the author of What Are Journalists For? Now, is this then to say that those that are disappointed, particularly the supporters of Barack Obama, are blaming the wrong guy, that we really should be blaming Obama, in a sense, for... It's essentially not taking on the other guy who clearly...
Right. I think it's absurd for disappointed supporters of Barack Obama to blame the moderator or ask him to inject things that the president failed to do. I think it's up to the president to inject into the debate what he wants to have there. And for supporters to look to the moderator for that is really a kind of a confession of having a weak candidate or a weak relationship with your candidate. So I don't think there's any way that that Lehrer is responsible for the president's performance or for Romney's performance.
Well, but there is a somewhat slavish politesse here in the press in terms of the way journalists relate to politicians, particularly on the PBS NewsHour, where the politicians invariably have these kind of love fests where they continually say, "I respectfully disagree with my learned colleague."
Mm-hmm.
And if you know, I grew up in Britain with the British journalism, where it's sort of journalism 101, where you ask a politician, "Now you said X on Thursday, and today you said Y. Were you lying on Thursday? Are you lying today?" And that was the very question that should have been asked last night, because the guy that showed up, Mitt Romney, was a different guy from the guy that's been campaigning.
That was not a part of how Jim Lehrer moderated the debate. He didn't see his role as challenging the candidates on their facts or on changes in their position. It's just not what he was there to do, the way he defined it. Now, there is, I think, within PBS especially, even more than NPR, but especially in PBS, there's... a kind of culture of deference to politicians, to certain kinds of authorized knowers or proved experts. But I don't think that that habit of deference is very visible to the people who run those programs and to Lehrer himself. They don't see it that way. We do. And I think that's part of the reason why he's moderated 12 debates, is that there is a deference there. He kind of feels it's, you give it your best shot. If he doesn't answer the question the first time or the second time, well, that's up to the viewers to know. And I think that's the style that he has developed at PBS, and that's part of the reason that he's chosen for that role.
Well, you would have thought, though, that when Romney said to him, essentially, "I'm going to get rid of your job, I'm going to cut funding for PBS, I'm going to put you out of business," you would have thought that might have got his attention.
Well, that is a revealing moment, because part of the attitude that the debate is about the candidates, it's not about the moderator, is that you are self-effacing, and that's what we saw then.
Mm-hmm. Well, is this then, Jay Rosen, really about the way that these debates are structured? They used to be in control by the League of Women Voters, and they tried to basically control it and make it more diverse and make it more, I think, user-friendly, and inject some substance and transparency in the process. And since the Debate Commission was formed by essentially lawyers for the Democratic and Republican Party, who control it all, that it's become this kind of managed piece of of rather boring theater?
I think that's basically right. I would put it in a bit of a different way. Debates, because they do represent this moment where both men or contenders step into the same physical space, which is also the same kind of psychological space, the same discourse space, because there is something genuinely powerful and real about that moment, it is like the beating heart of democracy. It's not that these debates are so great and they can be phonied up and controlled and managed, but part of the reason they have to be managed so tightly is that they are explosive. They are in some way touching the core of accountable government. And I think what's happened is that because they're so valuable to society, the parties realized they had to make them captive and give just enough of a real debate so that beating heart remains, but yes, try to manage it, try to make it as risk-free as possible while still risking something so that there can be a comeback, there can be, you know, a game changer. But it's all hedged about with a lot of controls and a lot of secrecy. And I think that's the testimony to how powerful the whole notion of two people alone on a stage arguing their vision for the country out in front of the nation really is and still is. And that's why 60 million people watch.
Well, but if you compare last night's first presidential debate to the number of debates that were had during the Republican primary, all of which were essentially organized by news outlets, and the candidates were only too happy to show up, and it seemed like the news outlet had control, and therefore the journalists and moderators seemed to have more control, and they were frankly more interesting. I mean, the candidates, some of them are off the wall, that is true, but I recall some fairly interesting exchanges. I didn't get much out of last night. I thought for all of the importance of the moment and what's at stake with the world's lone superpower, and who's going to be the head of the ship of state and the leader of the free world, it was a bit of a wash.
Yeah. Well, I think that reflects the fact that there's a politics or a political economy, if you will, to the organization of debates and the incentives that bring the Republican candidates to the arms of CNN or Fox during the primary season is very different than the forces that bring the two major party candidates together in the fall. And the institutional structure is different, and that results in a different kind of debate and a different kind of moderator.
Well, apparently somebody's talked to the president, because today on campaigning in Colorado, he went after Romney for essentially being a completely different person last night than the one that has been on the campaign trail. And I suppose to some extent, the way that Romney was able to completely reverse himself on all of his key positions and be somebody else, there was, an element of political risk in that with his own base, who he was essentially betraying. But on the other hand, they're so fired up in with hatred of Obama that they just want a winner. So they may forgive him. What's your reading on that?
My reading is that Romney has shown an extraordinary latitude in who he wants to be, where he wants to place himself, what he's willing to say, not say. It's been completely confusing and baffling in many ways what he hoped to achieve by that. But there may be a kind of logic to it, in the sense that it sort of assumes that there's no final court of appeal for who you are. There's no way to force a candidate to acknowledge a contradiction. There's no There are no discourse cops. There's no penalty. And I think that's the part of the election cycle in 2012 that has stumped a lot of people. And I think it's going to be one of the things that interpreters look at when the 2012 race is over is what is that style of campaigning where you don't really care if you contradict yourself. You don't really care if what you said Thursday makes no coherent sense with what you said Tuesday, and that there are certain advantages to it. And I think we saw that in the debate itself. Romney was sort of almost, in a sense, was able to claim everything. He liked all the good things about Obama's programs, and he could basically fictionalize the bad things. And being all over the place like that kind of worked for him in some crazy way. So I don't think we understand this part of the campaign very well. We just have some really crude names for it, like the post-truth politics of 2012, which isn't very satisfying.
Well, it seems fair. I mean, a lot of pundits that I've spoken to over the months have you know, the conventional wisdom is that politicians on the left move to the left in the primaries and move back to the center for the general, and the opposite's true on the right. And that's a tradition in American politics. And many people have been saying for a long time, how come Romney's still hugging the right all the way up to the last month? But last night he suddenly turned around and did a bait and switch and appealed to the center, knowing that he had a huge audience. So it seemed all of it seemed pretty tactical to me. I think he caught Obama by surprise. That's why Obama's out on the stump today. I mean, he did have a fairly lame response. Had he had the response that is journalism 101, you know, you said one thing one day and the next thing another day. Are you lying today or lying the other day? I mean, that at least would have pleased me. But the long and the short of it is, do you expect Jay Rosen, that the next debates are going to be a little more or a little less boring?
I don't really know. I try not to anticipate too much. When I really care about the event, and I certainly do in the case of the debates, I kind of try to approach them with, like, a more open attitude, like anything that happens sort of thing, even though that, it too, is in some ways naive. But I think these questions of whether campaigns are accountable for what they say is, in fact, a question. And I think that the Romney campaign is operating under a different premise than the Obama campaign about that.
Well, you mean they're 18th century people?
Well,
they believe in the age of
a lot of different ways to phrase that. That's
right.
Right.
They believe in the age of enlightenment, that the truth somehow sets you free. I thank you for joining us, Jay Rosen.
Thank you for having me again.
Again, I've been speaking with Jay Rosen. He's a professor of journalism at New York University. His award-winning blog, Press Think, at pressthink.org, puts forward critical analyses of journalism and the press. He's the author of the book, What Are Journalists For?, and numerous articles for The Nation, Columbia Journalism Review, The Chronicle of Higher Education, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Los Angeles Times. And he also serves as a member of the Wikipedia Advisory Board. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll come back and go to Venezuela to get an update on the presidential elections.
On fire, democracy rising, bounced on a wire, liberation. You can smell it in the air, things are moving, and the rich are all aware. Some will talk along the sidelines, others they will do. Sing a song for Chavez before the coup.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well. And you've covering the last few days of the final rallies in the election that takes place on Sunday for president of Venezuela. If Hugo Chavez wins, that'll mean he'll have another 6 years. And if he stays alive throughout that period, he will end up having served for 20 consecutive years. And then he's being challenged by a 40-year-old lawyer and former state governor, Enrique Capriles. Give us a sense of how close it is, because the polls are all over the place on this.
Yes, it's hard to give an exact answer on that because, like you say, the polls give anything from a 10-point lead for Chavez to a 3 or 4-point lead for Capriles. So it really does seem that it's going to be like a picture finale.
Photo finish, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, photo finish, I'm sorry.
Like a horse race.
On Sunday, yeah. Yeah, I don't dare to give you a prediction, which is strange because in the past, people here generally tend to know who the winner is going to be.
So how would you characterize this campaign so far? There have been a couple of deaths, a couple of Capriles' supporters were shot. But given how much violence there is in Venezuela, relatively speaking, that doesn't sound like it's been particularly violent.
Violence in Venezuela is usually crime-related, but Venezuela has never really been known for too many incidents of political violence, except, these sort of punctual failed attempts at a coup. So having these three leaders for the opposition camp killed on Sunday did come as a sort of quite dramatic turn in the campaign. Previous to that, there had been some attacks among the two opposing camps, but no deaths. For me, the Sunday incident that did escalate things a bit more than what we've been used to in 50 years of democracy.
So how has that affected the race? Has that given people pause? Because obviously it was Chavez's supporters who shot the three Capriles campaign workers. Has it helped Capriles?
It hasn't really affected the preference for either candidate at this point, but it did contribute to sort of an underlying feeling or tension that maybe one of the camps might not recognize the results and that there might be an episode of violence ensuing shortly after, which of course would be unfortunate and nobody's really planning for it, but there are growing rumors or growing concerns.
Well, Virginia Lopez, again, I'm speaking to Virginia Lopez in Caracas, Venezuela, where she's a journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and the BBC. And we're talking about Sunday's presidential elections and some of the violence that has happened in advance of this election. Now, when you talk about violence after the results come in, at least the counting of the votes is pretty straightforward, isn't it? It's not like here in the United States where we have an election where millions of potential Democratic voters are being purged from lists by all kinds of political chicanery on the part of the Republicans and Karl Rove. The Venezuelan vote, first of all, it's on a Sunday, which in most civilized countries vote on the weekends. And furthermore, isn't the Election Commission fairly nonpartisan or fairly tamper-proof?
The process of voting itself is pretty sort of bulletproof, to put it in those terms, and it's completely mechanized. There have been some issues about having a thumbprint scanner intimidate voters because it would mean that the secrecy of their vote is undermined. But most of the claims are coming from the fact that the members of the CNE have at times been linked to to political parties. This is a claim made by the opposition. Of course, the CNE members, you know, don't necessarily see themselves aligned to any party. There's also been criticisms from the opposition camp that the CNE doesn't, or the National Council for Electorate, or CNE in Spanish, hasn't regulated things like campaign time on TV, so that the government or the state has had more time on air than the opposition is allowed. So in that sense, you know, the electoral process itself seems a bit disproportionate, but not the voting day itself.
Well, my understanding is that in Venezuela, the politics are incredibly polarized because of the state television is entirely controlled by Hugo Chavez in the way that Pravda was controlled by the Politburo in Soviet Russia, and that conversely on that the independent press have been incredibly highly partisan against Chavez. Now, he's managed to close some of them down. So give us a sense of the press landscape, because to some extent we're used to this is a new phenomenon here in the United States with Fox News and MSNBC, where you have partisan cable television. But how does it translate in Venezuela? Who's got the upper hand in press exposure?
It's probably as polarized as society itself. It does seem that a lot of the private media is pro-opposition, and a lot of the state-run media is pro-government. So, I mean, in a sense, what you see here is that the boundaries between the state and the government are completely blurred. And you have state institutions being run for pro-government aims. Jimmy Carter had an interesting comment on it, sort of comparing Venezuelan campaigning to the U.S. campaign and saying, you know, he said something along the lines that the Obama campaign had been characterized by heavy private funding, and that Venezuela was almost a mirror image in that the campaign had been, or the government or the incumbent's campaign had been heavily funded by the state. So, you know, I thought that was an interesting comparison of sort of what seemed to be, like I said, mirror images of a similar trend, according to Jimmy Carter.
So does anybody know about Chavez's health, assuming that the polls are right and he's between, I think, 10 and 5% ahead, and the polls by law close on September the 30th, do they not? So there are no recent polls since September the 30th. But assuming he wins, does anybody know how long he will survive in office?
Nope, nobody knows. There's been no disclosure of official medical records. He looks strong in his campaign. It hasn't been the same Chavez that we're used to in previous campaigns, where he was doing these marathon nationwide campaigns. But, you know, today was the closure of his campaign, and it was raining, and you could sort of see him jumping on stage and being very energetic. But of course, you know, it's almost silly to try and predict somebody's health for what you can see on TV. And I can't think of any other country where a president wouldn't be forced to disclose his medical records after having been treated for cancer 3 times.
So his big finale will be in front of the presidential palace, I take it. That's going to be the last big rally. Will that be on Saturday or Sunday?
No, it's taking place as we speak.
Oh, actually. Today it is.
And I was there this morning, and it was massive. People were coming from all over the country, and about 7 of the main avenues of Caracas downtown packed with his supporters. It's a very impressive turnout.
And Mr. Capriles, he's chosen a stronghold of President Chavez, Barquisimeto. Tell me about why he's doing that.
Capriles had a campaign closure on Sunday here in the city in Caracas. And that, too, was very impressive. And the turnout was incredible. Again, you know, it's impossible to compare the two, because one is an incumbent that has access to a great machinery. Capriles himself has described the race as sort of David and Goliath. kind of campaign. Barquisimeto is, you know, like you said, it's a capital of a state with strong tariff support. He's been doing a really strong, robust campaign. He's been touring the whole country. He started with what he called the house by house, visiting, one house at a time, and then scaled up to town by town, going basically all across the country from small town to small town, and then ending on a city by city approach. The one that I went to was in Coro, which is a state capital, or a capital with a state refining facilities, where there had just been a refining accident. And again, you know, the upturn was gigantic, but it's just really difficult to compare. The day after that, I was at Chavez's rally in Cabimas, and it was equally as impressive. It's just really difficult to compare, like I said.
Again, I'm speaking with Virginia Lopez, who is a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom. Now, we have in this election here between Mitt Romney and the incumbent President Obama what's often referred to as the enthusiasm gap, that the supporters of Obama who voted for Hope and Change in 2008, a lot of them are disappointed and may not show up to vote. And conversely, there's a lot of enthusiasm on the Romney side with his core supporters, many of whom are consumed by an irrational hatred of Obama. So is there an enthusiasm gap in Venezuela in as much as Chavez's supporters apparently are very enthusiastic about him and very passionate, whereas Capriles' supporters aren't that passionate because he's not a charismatic character like Chavez is?
Actually, that's changed dramatically, and it's been quite interesting. Capriles has just grown during his campaign, and he went from sort of being, you know, giving very sort of short answers to questions to now engaging his audience. He's made a point of never offending President Chavez, and almost moving away from this sort of incendiary rhetoric that Venezuelans have become accustomed to in the last 14 years under Chavez. So it's a very refreshing change. I think it taught Venezuelans from both bands that politics doesn't necessarily need to be a matter of hating your opponent. He's youthful, and that's also very refreshing. And like I said, he's been, you know, running around the country very vigorously. His supporters, you know, it was when I went out on the campaign trail with him, it was sort of being like in a rock star concert. With Chavez, it's a bit of this sort of miracle work type thing, and his supporters sort of turn to him almost sort of as a deity that is capable of having miracles come true. Again, he's been in power for 14 years. He's seen the price of oil go from $9 to 100, which, you know, has been the largest windfall the country's experienced in its history. And he's used that money to a great extent to give what some consider social programs and what others think are, you know, cash handouts. So depending on what side of the political spectrum you sit, is basically how you see Chavez. But they're both, you know, awakened passions among their voters. It's going to be it's the tightest race we've seen since Chavez first came to power in 1998. And I think the tendency, even after the elections, is for Capriles to gain more and more momentum, regardless of what the final outcome is. There's going to be elections for governors in December. So again, the opposition could see itself strengthened, even if they didn't win in the presidential race.
In terms of the exile community of Venezuelans living here in the United States, there have been some stories about how they can't vote in Miami because the Chavez regime has always been hostile towards the Miami diaspora because it links them with the ancient regime, the coup plotters, etc. And, of course, there was a espionage charge brought against the consul general there. I think she was kicked out of the country. So people in Miami, the Venezuelan community there, in order for them to vote, they have to go to New Orleans. Is that a story that's being reported much in Venezuela?
Yes, it's gotten plenty of attention. There's a large population of Venezuelans that have moved to Miami during Chavez. Partly because crime is such an issue for many of them, and partly, well, you know, maybe searching new opportunities. But yes, it's they're expected to you know, go and drive whatever long it takes to go to New Orleans to vote there.
So that's the that's quite a that they'd have to be pretty dedicated to vote to go all that way. But I guess they're going to do it, right?
There's a lot of people coming from different parts of the world back to Venezuela this weekend just so they can vote. I know it sounds a bit extreme, but yeah, you know, it's been 14 years. I think it seems like people want to change.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Virginia Lopez.
Of course, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the other Gilded Age, not the one that we're in now.
Out on the edge of town, sir, rising above the factories and the fields. Ever since I was a child, I can remember the mansion on the hill.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Janet Wallach, who is the author of 9 books, including Desert Queen, The Extraordinary Life of Gertrude Bell, a frequent contributor to the Washington Post magazine and the Smithsonian magazine. She has written cover stories on leading Middle East personalities, and she co-hosted a nationally syndicated program, Private Lives, Public People, on the Lifetime Cable Network. Janet Wallach is a founding director and president emeritus of Seeds of Peace, a nonprofit organization created by her late husband, John Wallach, which received a UNESCO Peace Prize in 2000. Her new book just out is The Richest Woman in America, Hetty Green in the Gilded Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, Janet Wallach.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
And it seems that your specialty here, Janet, in apart from the enormous amount of work you've done on the Middle East and the personalities in the Middle East, has been to sort of uncover these interesting women who history has not really appreciated or understood. Is that a fair description of Hetty Green?
Yes, it is. Women who have really made a mark and done some interesting things, and I think it's a pity that they're not well known. They deserve to be known. And so, yes, it's been a great adventure for me discovering and doing research and letting people know about these fascinating women.
And in the case of Hetty Green, who died in 1916, at that time, she was worth $100 million, which is equal to about $2 billion today. She, of course, has been somewhat maligned by history, referred to as the Witch of Wall Street or the world's greatest miser. But you've painted an extremely deep and complex picture. So let's start with the context here, because many have argued, and I think fairly correctly, that we are in a kind of new Gilded Age. And so what was the significance? Was that your hook into exploring her, the sense that that her experience might resonate to what's happening today with the 99% versus the 1%?
You're absolutely right, Ian. In fact, when a friend of mine first suggested her name as a subject about 6 years ago, I said, "Who?" I'd never heard of her. I heard those, you know, those awful titles of Witch of Wall Street and Greatest Miser and so on. And then I started doing some research and looking into her, and discovered that this was a woman who not only really was victorious over enormous financial crises in her time, and that these things happen every 20 years or so. We seem to go through these cycles of the, you know, up into the stratosphere in terms of spending and borrowing, and then comes the great crash, and then there are years of suffering, and then we do it all over again. So I thought, This is not only interesting. This is a relevant story to tell, and I think it is, and I think we can learn something from the way she approached it and the way others did too.
So, continuing the contemporary analogies, how much is she like, for example, Warren Buffett?
I think she was quite similar. I mean, I kind of think of her as the 19th century female Warren Buffett. She had a very unemotional approach to investing. She did her homework. She studied her companies. She knew them inside out and upside down in terms of their financial insides. And she was very cool-headed, so that in a panic, when everybody was selling, she would be buying. And when everybody was buying in a frenzy, she would be selling. She knew when it was time to get in and when it was time to get out. And that doesn't mean necessarily getting in at the very bottom and getting out at the very top. But it does mean being aware of these cyclical patterns, and being aware of the madness of crowds, if you will.
Well, of course, many have argued that we are becoming, our democracy is turning into a kind of rule by an oligarchy, and our economy has become a plutonomy, again, harking back to the Gilded Age. And I suppose in that context, Buffett is somewhat on the side of the angels, if you compare him to, say, to the Koch brothers, who are kind of the Darth Vaders of capitalism today.
Right. I'm with you.
So tell me, my understanding of Hetty from your book, again, The Richest Woman in America, Hetty Green in the Gilded Age, Janet Wallach, is that she is a politically somewhat on the liberal side. She had compassion for the poor, or the 47%. And she, even though she was frugal in her own ways, she seems to also be fairly generous, at least in terms of her spirit. And she comes out of this extraordinary Quaker heritage.
Well, that's right, which set up a kind of split personality, I would say. You know, when she was a child, her family wanted to make sure that she wasn't spoiled, and they were a family of some money. But to make sure that she wasn't spoiled, they sent her to a Quaker boarding school, where, you know, thrift was an important message, where she practically had to eat mush every day, and if she didn't eat what was put in front of her, it was put back for the next meal until she finished it. And she also encountered a number of classmates who came from poor backgrounds, and her tuition at the school helped to pay for their education. So she was really helping to scholarship them, and she developed an empathy for others who did not have money. And she, all through her life, she appreciated people who appreciated her. she was wary of those who befriended her for her money. And I think it's wonderful. Well, somebody asked her why she was so affectionate towards her dog. And she said, because he doesn't know how rich I am. And I think that was a good part of it. But she did have empathy. Although I have to confess, on the other hand, she did not like to pay taxes, and she avoided them at all costs. So there was that side of her, too.
Well, but that's a fine and distinguished American tradition. And the only difference...
Not only American, right? Right? We're now finding out
right, but
all over the world.
Exactly. The difference being, of course, that we live with the delusion that we're overtaxed when we're one of the least taxed countries in the industrial world.
Right.
Again, I'm speaking with Janet Wallach, who's the author of 9 books, including Desert Queen, The Extraordinary Life of Gertrude Bell. Her latest book just out is The Richest Woman in America, Hetty Green in the Gilded Age. So just returning to the Quaker heritage, it's extraordinary to think how the small American religion, well, of course, it came from Europe originally, but it flourished here. Nevertheless, it's always been very small in number, but enormously great in its impact. Quakers have been at the forefront of the great historical movement, the emancipation, the women's suffragette movement, the civil rights movement, the nuclear freeze movement, the environmental movement. All of these great movements, if you scratch the surface a little bit, you find that the key people behind them were Quakers. I just find that extraordinary.
I think so. I would certainly agree with you. Well, they had a wonderful outlook in terms of conflict resolution. They believed in peaceful settlement. They believed they were not in favor of going to war. And it's interesting, however, that they supported the Civil War because they felt that they had to fight to free the slaves. So in that sense, war was almost inevitable. But yes, they have been at the forefront, and I think that again influenced Hetty Green's thinking, that she saw people in a different way than maybe others did, that she was open to everybody. She did not have biases against those who were poor or those who were working people. She was absolutely accepting of all. And in fact, unlike the great industrialists of her day, she didn't take advantage of people to make her money. She did it on her own. She never tried to get other people to invest their money with her. She did not use workers at low wages. None of that. She was very fair in her investing and in her employment of people.
So her reputation of being parsimonious and the notion that she carried $200,000 worth of bonds on a public bus and when she could have hired a private carriage, how much is that exaggerated? Because I know, for example, she tried to marry off her mousy daughter and was quite lavish in terms of throwing parties and stuff. So she wasn't. So did she deserve this reputation of being a miser?
I think she certainly was frugal, very careful with her money. But then again, she was not just a Quaker; she was a New Englander, and so that was very much in the manner of New England ways to be extremely thrifty with their pennies. She may have taken it to an extreme. She was told from the time she was a young child that the money that she had was her responsibility to protect, to increase, and to pass on to the next generation. And she really saw that as her job, her tremendous responsibility. And so she was 1,000% business and really didn't care about where she lived or what her clothing looked like. She was far more interested in being successful in her investing, which is, I think, kind of interesting. She did take it, though, to kind of an extreme. She lived in small apartments. She lived in boarding houses, which were not as bad as they sound. Boarding houses in her time could be very comfortable places with professional people living there in the other suites, other rooms. So, but she was extremely cautious with her money, and I think her children, particularly her son, went the other way just because he had been brought up with such miserliness.
Well, but she's such a contrast, given that, as I mentioned earlier, at the time of her death in 1916, she was worth at least $100 million, which is more than $2 billion in today's dollars. And what we see of her contemporaries today, the billionaires in America, so many of them appear to be, a lot of them believe that they're actually afflicted and that they're misunderstood. There's an interesting article in the New Yorker about that at the moment by Chrystia Freeland. There's also this, you know, extraordinary competition where they can't wait to have a bigger mansion in the Hamptons and a bigger Gulfstream jet. So she had no part of the trappings of the Gilded Age.
She absolutely shunned it. And it was certainly the same sort of competitive atmosphere then that we see today. Newport was filled with marble mansions, and the houses that were built in New York at the time, these Beaux-Arts mansions, in fact, I'm looking at one right now across the street from me, a Gothic mansion that was built in the Gilded Age that has every kind of icing on the cake that you could possibly imagine. This was not Hetty's style. She came from a background where simplicity, where plainness was respected far more than the froth. And that is how she lived. But certainly imagine the lavishness in the Gilded Age, the homes, the furnishings, the clothes, the cars when they came into style. All of it was just spectacular, really. And I think that in some ways, Hetty Green was resented because she didn't spend her money that way. She didn't want to live that way. And for many people, it's okay for others to make a fortune as long as they can relish the spending of it. But if somebody's going to make a lot of money and then hoard it, it doesn't quite seem fair. And I think that's what happened with Hetty. She did not allow the public the vicarious pleasure of enjoying her money. And I think that a lot of the bad press that she received came out of that attitude.
Again, I'm speaking with Janet Wallet, the author of the new book just out, The Richest Woman in America, Hetty Green in the Gilded Age. Now, she spent time in England married to Edward Green, who was apparently a fairly successful businessman, and signed a prenuptial agreement. Was that his idea? I thought it was a bad move on his part, right?
It was her father's idea.
I see.
Yes, he would not give his approval for the marriage unless Edward signed that agreement. And the agreement said that the couple would have to live on her husband's income and that her money was to be hers to protect, increase, and pass on to her children. And that's exactly what happened until he crossed the red line.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, what happened was Hetty was really an investor. She bought for the long haul. Edward was much more of a gambler and a risk taker, and he put his money into stocks that started tumbling. And when they did, and he was called, and he had bought them, of course, on margin, deep margin. When he was called for more cash, he used his wife's money, Hetty Green's money, as collateral. And when the stocks crashed and the bank called and said, okay, Mrs. Green, you have to pay, she was just wild. That was going, well, he had broken his promise. And so she sent him packing. She paid, but she sent him packing.
Well, she had to pay, right?
Yes.
It was a margin call. Right?
Yes.
But this is a woman who'd established a lifelong principle of never borrowing, and that had to be the worst kind of insult to her.
That's right.
So just in closing then, again, back to the contemporary period, the new Gilded Age that we're in, we actually have an exemplar of the 1% running for president of the United States, and he may well get elected. So it's conceivable that we will go further into the equivalent of the new Gilded Age. What's the lesson for readers of your book to take, Janet Wallach?
I think, you know, Hetty always said common sense was the most precious commodity that one could have. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to use our common sense when we're looking at the times, that it just doesn't make sense that 1% of the population should have the kind of wealth that it does. And at some point, the pendulum has to go the other way. But also, to keep a cool head in times of panic or in times of frenzied speculation, avoid risk. And that was her most important message, I think, along with common sense. And common sense says, don't take enormous risks, because there is an upside, but there is a huge downside. So if you invest wisely, know what you're doing, know your companies, do it for the long haul, and don't do it on margin, then even if the stocks go down, if they're solid companies, or if the real estate goes down, if they're solid properties, they will come back. We do always come back in this country. We have enormous resources, and you will be okay. But you just have to keep your calm, keep your cool, and stand aside while the others go mad and run around in circles of panic and fear.
Well, Janet Wallach, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Janet Wallach, who's the author of 9 books, including Desert Queen, The Extraordinary Life of Gertrude Bell, a frequent contributor to the Washington Post magazine and the Smithsonian magazine. She has written cover stories on leading Middle Eastern personalities and has co-hosted a nationally syndicated program, Private Lives, Public People, on the Lifetime Cable Network. Janet Wallach is the founding director and president emeritus of Seeds of Peace, a nonprofit organization created by her late husband, John Wallach, which received a UNESCO Peace Prize in 2000. Her new book just out is The Richest Woman in America, Hetty Green in the Gilded Age. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manas and Tariq Mohammed. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments, and the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.